Well, welcome back, everybody. Glad you could make it back to this edition of CIOs and Bowties. Your chief investment officer for the next 30 minutes or so will be myself, Greg Silberman. And we're going back to our roots this time, and we're getting deep into intermarket analysis, market analysis. Where's the market going for the longest time? You know, markets have really been volatility has been fairly absent. And so we're seeing a bit of volatility now. And so we felt like the best bet for us today would be to get my old friend, Michael Gayed from Pension Partners on the line. So let me read you a brief bio of Michael. Michael's been steeped in stock analysis, market analysis, I think from the get-go. Let's see, Michael, you launched your own long short fund. You were a portfolio strategist at AmeriCap Advisors, and today you are the, I would call it, senior portfolio manager at Pension Partners, running various strategies, one of which is the ATAC rotation strategy, which we'll go into detail soon. Michael, you've probably seen Michael. He is all over all the time. He's a contributor to CNBC, Bloomberg TV, a prodigious writer himself, and just features everywhere where market intelligence is to be found. So welcome, Michael. Good to have you on the show.
I feel like my mother must have given you a call to tell you all those good things about me.
She did. Wonderful woman. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, Mike. So look, let's set the table, as it were, for our listeners, and give us a little bit of an idea of, you know, what is ATAC rotation and what is this investment philosophy? Because it's slightly unique, I would say. What is the investment philosophy of Pension Partners and what is the ATAC rotation strategy?
Yeah, so look, I think when it comes to this business, there's a natural predisposition to want to approach strategies from the standpoint of forecasting, right? Meaning, are we in a bull market? Do you position based on that? Are we in a bear market? Do you position based on that? Rather than sort of viewing markets from the perspective of conditions that favor an outcome. Now, in terms of the way we kind of look at things and the way that, you know, I write about things, everything we do is, you know, in some large degree really related to identifying the weather, the conditions that favor a particular situation, whether it's an ongoing bull market, a collapse in stocks, so on and so forth. And there are certain leading indicators that tell you the so-called weather of the market. I've co-authored four different papers which have won four separate awards, all of which have the same conclusion that there are certain areas of the marketplace from a relative perspective that will tell you in advance to start slowing down in the event that an accident, a crash, or a correction happens. In terms of the ATAC strategy, you know, that's using two very specific quantitative signals, essentially the behavior of utilities and treasuries, watching them for early signs of what could be a, you know, flip in risk on or risk off sentiment. And, you know, I liken the analogy to driving, right? If you are in a risk on period, you can, you know, go at the speed limit, maybe go past it. If you're in a risk off period, you want to slow down as you're entering the storm. Hopefully the accident doesn't happen, but you've got to start taking steps to just mitigate the possibility that it does happen.
Okay. What's this relationship between utilities and treasuries that we need to be watching out for?
So in the 2014 Dow Award paper, we document that if you go back to the 1920s, generally when the utilities sector is outperforming the broader stock market on a short-term basis, you'll tend to see higher average volatility with a lag afterwards. The thinking there is that because utilities are so interest rate sensitive, because they are the least cyclical sector of the stock market, arguably the sector that is most like the bond market, mm-hmm. given how tied, you know, utility companies are to interest rates, that their movement tells you something about the demand for money and changes in the demand for money. Utilities, because they are so highly leveraged, are very much dependent upon the cost of capital. Cost of capital historically tends to be lower when demand for money is lower, which is tends to coincide with lower growth and inflation expectations. Same kind of finding with treasuries. When long-duration treasuries on the 30-year side are outperforming intermediate, a form of yield curve flattening, the same kind of conclusion can be shown, which is that historically, on a purely back-tested quantitative basis, volatility for stocks tends to rise afterwards. And again, I think that makes sense because arguably in a capitalist system, interest rates are everything. They drive liquidity. They drive risk sentiment. And to the extent that these areas are more sensitive to interstate movement, they might, you know, arguably get ahead of equity market price gyrations before equity investors really realize what's happening in terms of the sort of change in the environment.
Okay. So relative performance of one class of interest rate versus another, or utility versus Dow. Okay, I get it.
Right.
And I'm going to challenge you on that in a little while. But first, you know, your recent pieces that I've been looking at have been flashing the red sign. Let's put it this way. So to quote the great Michael Gayed, a crash sometime in spring, sometime in mid-May, looks like a good time frame. Well, Michael, as I'm sitting here today and we're recording this, you know, Dow's down 1.5%. It's a lot of red out there. So what led you to this belief? And, you know, it looks like you're quite prescient here. So maybe develop the theme a little. Well, what should we be expecting?
So there's a few things, I think. And before we maybe get too deep into sort of the discussion around, you know, crash or no crash, just to be clear, when I started making the case that it was a very real possibility, people started thinking I was making a call on stocks. It's not a call. It's about probabilities. And given some of these intermarket relationships, you know, that I track, at least historically, when you tend to see disconnects like what we've seen in the last several weeks, you tend to see big stock market declines afterwards if it's a true positive in the sense that it's a real risk-off period and these areas are getting ahead of it. So the number one thing I've been hammering is that following the December lows, markets have had a very large move. You've had an unrelenting V-like motion, especially in the S&P, especially in the NASDAQ and tech stocks. But at the same time, you've seen an incredible lack of participation really in lumber. Now, a lot of people scratch their head because they don't understand why in 2019 somebody would be talking about wood or trees as an indicator for the market. Until you start to actually dive into the actual back-tested quantitative undeniable research, which is to say that lumber is a key component to housing.
Mm-hmm.
As lumber's price performance behaves, so too goes expectations on housing activity. Housing activity is the number one thing that drives U.S. consumer wealth, and as such, it's largely a predictor of economic growth and inflation expectations. Now, the fact that lumber has essentially stayed towards the lows of last year and has not come back the way large cap indices have, to me, is a big red flag because it suggests that there's some kind of anticipation of a slowdown in housing, which would ultimately filter down to the consumer and the economy. So that's, now historically, and again, this is from a purely objective quantitative basis, lumber has, its movement has preceded a lot of major periods of crisis in the stock market, including the 1987 crash, the 1990 housing recession, LTCM, 2000 to 2002, 2008, weeks before Lehman, lumber had turned lower, suggesting something might be off. And mostly the summer crash of 2011, and you're starting to see, you know, kind of very serious divergences now in a similar way. Now, just because lumber is weak does not guarantee you that you have a crash, but historically, at least when lumber is this weak, the odds are higher, right, of that kind of crash. Now, that does coincide with other relationships which are unusual in terms of the way, you know, the narrative is about the bull market. Small cap stocks, which are more domestically sensitive, have not recouped their losses fully from the highs of last year. A lot of sectors have been in general weak. Energy continues to be weak. The reflation trade continues to be weak. And yields have not kind of synced back up. If you recall, a lot of the reason it's been argued that this rally occurred is because the Fed changed its stance in terms of, you know, the likelihood of ongoing interest rate hikes. If that's the case, that should be inflationary because it means they're willing to keep rates lower for longer and kind of slow down on the average rate level. The issue, of course, is that yields on the long end have stayed quite low and you haven't seen sort of a trend higher in yields as the S&P has pushed higher. So it goes back to sort of this bigger question. When you look at markets, what is the real leading indicator? Is it that which is the S&P 500, or which is largely driven by buybacks, or is it really everything else which arguably is more sensitive to the cycle?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. A lot to digest from that. And I, you know, you had me at intermarket analysis. I got to be honest with you. It's a real passion of mine. I love it. So, Michael, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to develop this theme a little bit more of intermarket analysis and ask Michael his opinion on some other factors.